This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hello, joining me in the studio this week is Dr. Rebecca Bowler. Rebecca, would you like to introduce yourself?
Oh, hi there. So my name is Rebecca Bowler and I am an astrophysicist at the University of Oxford, where I'm studying how galaxies form in the early universe.
Okay, so give a brief overview then of what you're doing about galaxy formation.
So what we want to know is how galaxies form after the Big Bang. So after the Big Bang, the universe was really in chaos. There was just a kind of soup of particles. But we know today that we have all these really interesting structures. We have galaxies, we have planets, we have us. And so what I'm trying to do is connect those two things. I'm trying to work out how the superparticles cooled and became kind of atoms that we understand today. And those eventually formed stars and galaxies. And it's those stars and galaxies that I'm trying to observe. So I use telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope and eventually the James Webb Space Telescope to observe these very distant galaxies.
I suppose firstly then, you mentioned the Hubble Space Telescope. How come that's what you're using? What about it makes it good for that?
So Hubble is a fantastic instrument for many different reasons. Firstly, it's in space, so that means it's above our atmosphere. And our atmosphere causes a lot of problems for astronomers. It means that the images we have are not sharp enough for a lot of the science questions we want to answer. It also means that certain wavelengths of light are blocked. So, for example, ultraviolet light from the sun is blocked by our atmosphere. Some ultraviolet light, I should say, which is actually quite good for us as humans living on the surface of the Earth. But it's bad for astronomers because we can't look at certain parts of the spectrum that we're interested in. So that's a few reasons why. So it's above the atmosphere, so we get clearer images, and it allows us to look at the full colours of galaxies that we're interested in.
So that's an interesting point that we should talk about. You mentioned then the colours of galaxies.
Yeah.
Why is that the important thing you're looking at? What is it about the colour of a galaxy?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the galaxies I'm looking at are extremely distant objects. So because of the expansion of the universe and because the speed of light is constant, astronomers kind of use images of the sky like time machines. So if you imagine a galaxy is very, very far away, the light has travelled a very long way to get to us. And on its journey, several things have happened. So the first thing is it's made it very, very, very faint. So the galaxy is very hard to actually detect and see because it's so far away and the light has been spread out on its journey. The other thing that's happened is it's become redder. So as the universe expands and the light travels through the universe, its light is stretched and it's made redder. So this is what we call redshift. So what I'm looking at is extremely high redshift galaxies because they're extremely distant. So this means that we need very specific observations to find them. We can't just look in the optical regime, like the wavelengths we can see with our eye. What we need is redder. We need to see redder light to detect these distant galaxies. And that's one of the reasons why the Hubble Space Telescope is so powerful. It's above the atmosphere and it's sensitive to this redder light that we care about.
That's the why of this then. What sort of things have you been finding out so far about these early galaxies?
So the observations are very challenging of these sources. And so quite a lot of my effort actually goes into finding them in the first place. So I spend most of my time searching for these distant objects in imaging data. Once we've found them, though, there are quite a lot of interesting things we know about them. So the first thing is that they are very young, kind of turbulent systems. So they're not galaxies like the Milky Way. They're not like nice spiral galaxies. They're really chaotic, irregular objects because they're so young. They're just the first galaxies that are formed in the universe. So we know that they are kind of young, bright objects forming a lot of stars. We also know that they have a very irregular morphology, so they're not spirals and they're not ellipticals like you might see more locally. They're kind of irregular objects. And we also know that they have a very different chemical composition to galaxies that we're more familiar with. And that's because they're formed out of pristine gas. So they're formed out of gas that has really, nothing has happened to it yet. It's just been formed after the Big Bang. And this is the first thing that's happened to it. It's formed into a star and a galaxy. So this means that its chemical composition is very pure. It's essentially, astronomers call it low metallicity. It means that there's not many heavy, interesting elements. There's no carbon, there's no iron. It's just a very pristine system.
So you've explained why it was pristine from the point of view of the galaxy evolving, but how do you actually measure that?
So to measure this chemical composition of these early galaxies, what we really need is a spectrum. So a spectrum is essentially you split up the light, just like if you look at a prism, you split up the white light into all of its different colours. And on this kind of spectrum of colours, you see these characteristic dark patches and light patches. And these are what we call emission and absorption lines. And these are essentially fingerprints of the elements that are present in the galaxy. So, for example, if you look at our sun, you see these dark absorption lines, and this tells you that there are certain elements in its atmosphere, like calcium, for example. There are atoms of calcium in the atmosphere. And we can do exactly the same thing at a much, much greater distance than our sun. So looking at these galaxies, spreading their light out and looking at these fingerprints of different elements. And what we see is a much lower proportion of kind of interesting heavy elements that make up the Earth.
Okay, so we're finding out a few things about these then. Is there anything else you found out other than sort of the composition and general shape?
Yes, so my specialty is looking at kind of extreme galaxies at early times in galaxy formation. So what I'm especially interested in is kind of monster galaxies that have formed in the early universe. So we look to galaxy formation and evolution simulations for clues into how galaxies formed, because we don't have that much information about this time from observations. And by comparing observations and simulations, we found quite a lot of differences, and this is really interesting. And in particular, my research focuses on the brightest galaxies and the galaxies that are forming the most stars. And these are things that are not predicted at all by simulations, but we're finding them. So this is a really interesting test of what we know about the physics that's happening in the early universe. We can directly compare the observations in theory, and we see that there's a discrepancy.
What discrepancy are you finding?
So basically, we found more galaxies than we were expecting, which is a nice position to be in, actually, because sometimes you look for something and you don't see anything, but this time we actually found too many. But this is really interesting, because it means that something is wrong with how we are simulating galaxies. It means that something is wrong in the way that we are making the computer form stars, basically. It can't be right, because the simulation said there shouldn't be any of these very, very large galaxies, but we found about 20 of them.
So difference between none and 20 that you've already found. That does sound rather severe, that difference.
Yes.
So are there any attempts then to try and solve this discrepancy?
So this is something I'm really interested in. And there's several interesting possibilities that could be causing this difference between the simulations and the observations. So one of them could be in the way we treat dust. So I'm not talking about dust that you find in your house. I'm talking about cosmic dust. I'm also not talking about the cosmic dust that's in the Northern Lights trilogy that you might have seen on TV. I'm talking about the dust we see in galaxies. So if you look at the Milky Way, you see these dark patches. These are due to kind of dust lanes in the Milky Way. So essentially what dust does is it hides stars. So if you were able to see through this dust in the Milky Way, you would see way more stars than you can see just by looking up in the night sky. And we think the same effect could be causing this discrepancy that we find. So essentially we think that the simulations are not putting in the dust quite right. So what that means is they're putting in too much dust and it's hiding these sources. So they are in the simulations, they're just hidden. They're just hidden from view.
Okay.
And if we were to go and rejig the way that this is done in the computer, we could hopefully boost the number of these objects to match what we see in the observations.
Is there then sort of other predictions that you could make to try and verify this? Because at the moment, okay, you change the simulations to then match reality, but then could you then go on and predict more things for the simulations to see that you don't just keep changing them and changing them and hoping it works?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's incredibly important to test lots of different things in the simulations because they are incredibly complicated and sometimes they produce something about the galaxies perfectly, but they completely do not reproduce some other property of the galaxy. For example, they might give you the right colour, but then the morphology or the shape is completely wrong. So we have to make sure we're testing these in multiple different ways. So what we can do actually is use a new telescope called ALMA, which is Atacama Large Millimeter Array, to look directly for this dust. And that's a really, really powerful technique because then we have two separate measurements that we can then go back to the simulations with.
So how come then ALMA is able to observe this dust when your other observations weren't really about that?
Yeah, so the most of the observations we currently have of these distant galaxies are looking at the light from stars. So we're looking directly at the light from the young stars in these galaxies. What ALMA does is it looks in a completely different regime. It's a radio telescope, effectively. And that means it can look at a completely different frequency range or wavelength range than our current observations. So instead of looking at the starlight, ALMA and other radio telescopes, when pointed at our interesting galaxies, are actually looking at the dust. So they're detecting the emission from this dust, which is, people say it's warm, but what they actually mean by warm dust is about 40 Kelvin. So that is not really that warm. But for astronomers, we say that that's warm. And this warm dust, it radiates, and we're able to pick this up with a radio telescope.
Okay, and then so once you pick that dust up, you can compare it with your models, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
So this brings us on to a point that keeps coming up almost every interview I have. We look at something in astronomy in one wavelength or in some with one telescope, and then suddenly we say, okay, actually, we'll combine that with this one. This time we started with Hubble, combined it with ALMA. Are there any other telescopes that you're going to add to the mix or just throw at it to see if they find things?
Our astronomers always want more data. They never have enough data. That's definitely true. Of course, all astronomers at the moment are waiting on tenterhooks for James Webb Space Telescope. And that's going to be exceptionally useful for my sort of science. It's actually going to completely revolutionise the study of the first galaxies. And the reason why that's kind of interesting for the galaxies that I'm talking about is because it's kind of in between what we currently have from Hubble and ALMA. So it's giving you infrared wavelengths that are redder than what Hubble can see. And this is going to tell you about the older stars in the galaxy and also a little bit about the dust as well. So that's going to be really powerful at joining these two observations together.
So how come it is then so much better? What about it makes it better?
So there's several reasons why it's so much better. So I spoke about how we want to go to redder wavelengths when we're looking at these distant galaxies because of the redshifting of the light. James Webb is redder than Hubble, so this enables us to look at, firstly, more distant galaxies, and also the galaxies we currently know, it enables us to look at different types of stars in that galaxy. It's also just much bigger than Hubble, so Hubble has a mirror that's around 2.5 metres in diameter, whereas James Webb is 6.5 metres in diameter, so it has a much larger collecting area. Again, we're looking at extremely distant objects. They're very hard to detect. So just having a larger mirror makes a massive difference in this respect. So something that has taken, you know, many days to observe with our current facilities, you can do it in almost minutes, you know, less than an hour with James Webb. So that just makes it incredibly efficient to look at many more of these sources we're interested in.
And is there anything in particular you're hoping to find with it?
So James Webb is, as I said, it goes redder than Hubble, and it's also got a larger mirror. So those two things are really helpful. But in fact, the most groundbreaking thing about the James Webb Space Telescope is that it's not just an imaging telescope. It's a really, really a spectroscopic machine. So it's going to be doing spectroscopy, so splitting of the light, in the infrared for the first time. So that is, as well as the kind of other things I said, it's the spectroscopy that's going to be the most groundbreaking for many different parts of astronomy. And in particular, in these very distant galaxies, what it's going to enable us to do is to make very good estimates of the chemical composition. So I said we already knew a little bit about this, but that's only from a very limited low signal to noise, a limited wavelength range we've had available to us before from the ground-based telescopes or from Hubble. James Webb, it gives you a wavelength range which has got a lot more information in it. So it's going to tell you a lot more about the chemical composition. Absolutely, that's going to be pinned down to much greater precision. But it's also going to enable us to look at things like, are there active black holes in these sources or not? So this has been quite an interesting debate in the field recently, actually, whether some of the properties of these sources can be explained if they are like active galactic nuclei, like if they have black holes at their centre. And it's not something we can currently constrain. But with James Webb, this new wavelength range, we'll be able to look at, essentially, you look at the ratio of emission lines, and this tells you whether there's an active black hole there or not. So that's going to be really exciting to see whether our observations can be completely reinterpreted in this different way.
And then if there are active black holes in these galaxies, does that then change the way we think about how early galaxies form? Is that something that's not expected?
Yes, absolutely. So we know there must be black holes there, but the only observations of active black holes and quasars in the early universe have been in very, very luminous, bright objects. So objects where the black hole is dominating the whole thing you see. But we know in the kind of normal galaxies that we're detecting, there must be black holes there. We see this locally. We always see a supermassive black hole in the centre of the galaxy. So we're really confident that they're there, but we don't know whether they're going to look the same as they do more locally. So what I mean by that is what we see in low redshift galaxies is that the size of the black hole is coupled to the size of the galaxy, essentially, or the mass of the galaxy. How that relationship was formed is not known, and perhaps when you go to these very distant objects, that hasn't happened. So you could have a massive galaxy with a tiny black hole, and you could have a tiny galaxy with a massive black hole. And it maybe it takes time, for example, galaxy mergers and so on, for the kind of one-to-one relationship we see at low redshift to form. We don't know. And the other question is, are these active black holes impacting their galaxy? So there's a lot of talk in people studying galaxy formation about how the tiny black hole at the center of the galaxy impacts the whole object. So, for example, sometimes they produce very strong jets and these can impact the galaxy. We don't know if this is going to be happening in these distant objects, and that's a really interesting question we can probe with James Webb.
So that's another one for the future then.
Yes, we can make some headway with these questions already with current data. So there are existing observations in the X-ray and in the radio, and typically active black holes give you signatures in the X-ray and the radio. So we're currently looking at the current data available to try and work out if there are active black holes in these sources. But with James Webb, I think it will be easier.
Yes. I suppose that's a good time to wrap up then. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye. Back to the studio.